Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Another grim milestone. The U.S. surpasses 50,000 deaths from COVID-19 as Georgia begins to reopen despite warnings from public health officials. Then to the sprawling Navajo Nation, where health is already precarious and residents can't wait any longer for the U.S. government to help.
It's taken too long. Here in Indian country, we're always, it seems to me, we're always at the bottom of the list when it comes to federal resources.
And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the latest political response and President Trump's leadership and advice during this unsettled time. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Parts of the country have begun to lift pandemic restrictions tonight. At the same time, the number of deaths in the United States has now reached a stunning 50,000. John Yang has our report on the developments of this day.
Good morning.
In Georgia today, businesses opened their doors for the first time in more than a month. Governor Brian Kemp lifted restrictions on such non-essential operations as bowling alleys and hair salons. While many small business owners, ravaged by the pandemic's economic hit, welcome the move, others are still on edge.
Nervous, anxiety, all that too, but, you know, we all want to come back to work.
With infections and deaths still rising, Georgia has not yet met the White House benchmarks for beginning to reopen. Despite that, the Associated Press reported today, President Trump had originally told Kemp he supported the move. Later, though, Mr. Trump told reporters he was unhappy with the decision. And on Twitter today, he said businesses should take a little slower path to reopen. In an interview with radio station WTAM in Cleveland today, Vice President Mike Pence was optimistic about how much longer the virus would grip the nation.
I think, honestly, if you look at the trends today, that I think by Memorial Day weekend, we will largely have this coronavirus epidemic behind us.
Georgia is one of only a handful of states poised to relax stay-at-home orders. In Madison, Wisconsin, dozens of protesters demanded that their governor do the same. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who's facing similar pressure, said today she would begin easing restrictions.
The new executive order will now allow some workers who perform lower-risk activities to go back on the job. We will consider this the preliminary stage of economic reengagement.
But she extended her stay-at-home order, set to expire at the end of the month, through May 15th. Meanwhile, the makers of Lysol and other disinfectants warn people against improper use of their products. It comes after President Trump seemed to suggest that researchers look into using disinfectants and ultraviolet light inside the bodies of those infected with the virus.
By injecting disinfectants.
Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the president was rejecting science.
Clearly and sadly, the president is not listening to medical experts, and I don't know which ones he is listening to, if any. As I said to my colleague last week, I said America must ignore the lies and start to listen to scientists and others. Respected professionals.
And after signing the latest economic rescue package into law, the president said he didn't mean it.
But I was asking a very sarcastic question to the reporters in the room about disinfectant on the inside. But it does kill it, and it would kill it on the hands, and that would make things much better. That was done in the form of a sarcastic question to the reporters.
Overseas, as the virus continues to spread, medical workers struggle to secure scarce equipment. That includes countries in Africa, which this week saw infections surge by more than 40%. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world began Ramadan under strict lockdowns. That leaves many to observe the holy month from home, resigned to putting off the evening prayers and get-togethers that normally mark the period of fasting, reflection, and community. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
As John reported, the White House spent some time today addressing concerns about the president's seeming conflict with his health and medical advisors. As Yamiche Alcindor reports now, it is not the first time the president and his own team of experts haven't appeared to be on the same page.
Yesterday, President Trump raised eyebrows when he said this.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that? By injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that.
Today, the White House said he was joking, but President Trump has repeatedly contradicted health officials during the coronavirus pandemic. Just a day earlier, the president pushed back on a story in the Washington Post that included a warning from the director of the Centers for Disease Control. Robert Redfield said a second wave of the coronavirus in the fall could be even more difficult to handle.
Dr. Robert Redfield was totally misquoted in the media on a statement about the fall season and the virus.
I'm accurately quoted in the Washington Post as difficult.
And for weeks, President Trump has repeatedly pushed for wider use of drugs used to fight malaria, though those drugs have not been fully tested in their effectiveness against COVID-19.
What do you have to lose? They say take it. I'm not looking at it one way or the other, but we want to get out of this. If it does work, it would be a shame if we didn't do it early.
Despite President Trump's public support, the science behind hydroxychloroquine as a coronavirus treatment is unproven. A National Institutes of Health study found an increased death rate in COVID-19 patients treated only with that drug. The NIH said there is insufficient clinical data to recommend using it. Just today, the Food and Drug Administration agreed and said the drug can cause abnormal heart rhythms. The Trump administration has also faced questions after a leading vaccine expert was removed from his job at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Rick Bright plans to file a whistleblower complaint. He alleges he was fired for pushing back on President Trump's promotion of hydroxychloroquine, saying in a statement, quote, "Sidelining me in the middle of this pandemic and placing politics and cronyism ahead of science puts lives at risk." Questioned about Dr. Bright's claims today, President Trump said he doesn't know the man. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
Amna Nawaz has more on these concerns around the president's statements and how public health experts see the risks ahead.
Judy, we're going to ask one of the leading voices on infectious disease about all of this. Dr. Michael Osterholm is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thank you very much.
I want to begin by asking you about something the president said yesterday. It's gotten a lot of reaction today. He floated the idea of using ultraviolet lights and disinfectants to possibly combat COVID-19. He said today he was being sarcastic. But what did you think when you first heard those remarks?
Well, I stopped listening to the daily briefings. I think I'm one of many in our business who have. So I didn't hear them. I only saw them reported secondhand. But I can tell you, even my 10-year-old grandson wondered what they were all about.
But what do you mean by that?
I think it was obvious that these are not realistic or even for that matter, potentially safe approaches. And so that in understanding the comments, one had to just take them for the non-scientific basis upon which they were stated.
You know, can I ask you, though, because it's not the first time that the president has made statements that either aren't backed up by science or contradict science, and they do have some effect. We just heard today from the office of the Maryland governor where they said they got over 100 calls from people calling to the state emergency hotline and asking if they could use disinfectant or either ingest it or inject it to combat the virus. Do you worry about the effect of that kind of continued messaging coming from the White House?
Well, first of all, there's really two aspects to this issue about messaging. Number one is, in fact, yes, we don't want to do harm. And throwing out comments without having vetted them with experts. But I think equally challenging going forward is that we are in for some really rough days coming yet. And that's where credibility and leadership are going to be everything. You have to trust the individual who is telling you how bad things are, how bad they will get, and where is the credibility coming from? We are going to need FDR-like fireside chats through the course of the next year to 16, 18 months. And these kind of events don't instill any kind of confidence that those can happen.
Yeah, Dr. Osterholm, as Americans are trying to plan for their future, I want to ask you about something you said about the timeline. You said when it comes to the virus, we're in the second inning of a nine-inning game. When you look at some of the other comments made by experts about second and third waves, what is it Americans should prepare for ahead?
You know, at this point, we don't know how it'll play out. And what I mean by that is that we are going to find a virus wanting and moving forward to infect 60 to 70% of us. That's just simply how much infection is going to have to occur and develop immunity in the population before it will start to shut down that transmission. But I just would remind everyone that if you look back on the influenza virus model of pandemic flu, what we saw were waves. We have the last 10 influenza pandemics for the past 250 years. They emerged two in our northern hemisphere winter, three in our spring, two in our summer, and three in the fall. And in every instance, about 6 months after the initial wave hit, we saw a much larger peak, a bigger wave that hit. And I think here we don't know if this is going to do that. This is a coronavirus. It's not a flu virus, but it's surely one acting like a flu virus. And people have to be aware of this and understand that whatever we're going to do to kind of control it over the upcoming months is not going to be easy, and it may take multiple different efforts to do that, but it's not over with by a long shot.
So given that, given how many more Americans you think will still become sick, do you think it's too early for states to be talking about reopening?
Well, I don't think at this point that whether we open up now or not is going to dictate what happens. So I think we're going to see in some of the states an acceleration and amplification of the cases that are occurring now by opening up. But I think in the end, 2 months from now, we could see a very quiet country with regards to this virus and everyone feeling, oh, we're fine now, only to come back with a major blast in the summer or fall. And so I think that's what we have to be mindful of, is that the starts and stops of coming out of lockdowns are likely going to be many.
You've previously estimated that the death toll of the virus could top 800,000. When you look at all the steps that have been taken up until right now, do you still believe it could go that high?
Just think about it. If there's 320 million Americans, a half of that, 160 million, are very likely to get infected, and those are numbers you can decide to change however you'd like, but that surely is a solid number. Of those, about 80% are going to have very mild or moderate illness, not seeking medical care, and in some cases not even know that they were infected. The remaining 20%, about 10% of those, or half, will not need really major medical care, possibly doctor's offices, visits. 10%, the remaining 10% will likely be hospitalized, which about half of those, or 5% of the total, will need intensive care hospitalization. And about one half to 1% of the total will die. You can change those numbers however you like. You know, put them in, just make sure you explain how you got what you did. And if you look at one half to 1% of 160 million, that's 800,000 to 1.6 million people. You can see we have a lot left to go before we're going to see this virus end, even with a vaccine coming down the pike.
That's Dr. Michael Osterholm of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
In the day's other news, the Congressional Budget Office warned of a tidal wave of red ink from the pandemic. It forecast a deficit of $3.7 trillion this year. Despite that news, Wall Street managed a rally. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 260 points to close at 23,775. The NASDAQ rose 139 points, and the S&P 500 added 39. The U.S. Navy is asking that Brett Crozier be reinstated as captain of the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt. The NewsHour has learned that the recommendation came today. Crozier was fired after he appealed to evacuate the ship as COVID-19 broke out on board. The man who fired him, then acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley, was heavily criticized and quit. In Yemen, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia today extended a unilateral ceasefire for 1 month. It said that the pause will help to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. Rebels backed by Iran have refused to accept a ceasefire, and both sides blame the other for continuing attacks. Meanwhile, the Taliban has rejected the Afghan government's call for a ceasefire during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The militant said there can be no truce until a peace process is fully underway. And the Hubble Space Telescope today marked its 30th year in orbit. It was launched on a space shuttle in 1990 and began sending back stunning images. One of the newest shows two vast clouds of space dust and gas, 163,000 light years away. Still to come on the NewsHour, on the front lines with an ICU nurse who has seen more death in the past month than many see in a lifetime. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar on the latest response to COVID-19. The pandemic's devastating effect on the uniquely vulnerable people of the Navajo Nation. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the end of another historic week, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Since this pandemic began, we have been trying to capture the experiences of people working on the front lines of the battle against it. William Brangham spoke today with a young nurse who has been at the very center of this outbreak and struggling with his own role in it.
That's right. We have been hearing a lot of stories from doctors and nurses and administrators who are caring for the sickest patients in this epidemic. But honestly, one of the most striking things I've read so far has been what KP Mendoza wrote recently on Facebook. He's a 24-year-old ICU nurse in New York City. This is just a sample of what he wrote. "I thought I was prepared to see death. I had seen enough of it within my first year in the ICU. Yet in the last 2 weeks, I have seen more people die than most people see in their entire lives. Now, I am not so sure if death is something I am prepared to see anymore. Death is different now. Death could pick me." The writer of those words, KP Mendoza, is with me now. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, William. I appreciate it.
Can you just, as I said, this dispatch that you wrote felt like just a sudden outpouring of what had been pent up for a long time. What was it that prompted you to write this in the first place?
Yeah, it was the end of a particularly difficult week. So it's been about a month and a half since I've only been seeing COVID patients in the ICU where I work. And that week had been difficult because I had had three patients again at that point, and I was just kind of really tired of not feeling competent enough to take care of three patients because the typical ICU ratio is two patients to one nurse. And so having three patients who are really sick just makes you feel like you're never giving enough adequate care. And I was like, now let me just write down how I feel, and I don't want to forget how I feel in this moment. And that's kind of what prompted me to write all that.
We've heard a lot, obviously, about the shortages of protective gear for people like yourself. And you've said it's gotten so bad at times for you that you even considered writing a will, which is not something most 24-year-olds do. I mean, is it still like that?
It's funny. I was actually talking about that idea with my coworkers the other day, because after what I had written got out, I think a part of me also is kind of resigning myself to the fact that either I currently have it, have had it, or will have it. And then there's this innate fear that if I do get tested for it, for the antibodies, say, that if I test negative, will that fear resume, or will that panic come back? And I think that's what bugs me. So it wavers. It wavers because some days I go in fearless, and some days I come out like a coward. And it's a strange wavering between confidence and a fear for my life. That was one reason that I felt the need to write it. And it was mostly for that. I didn't have the heart to tell my parents how I felt. you know, I don't want to tell them that I think about dying. The last thing I'd want to do is put them through that. So ultimately, I knew that they were going to see it, but to have to say that to them over the phone or over FaceTime would, I don't think I could do it.
You also wrote about your parents, about how you said when you were in college, you felt like you didn't have enough time to call them and check in with them. But now that you in the ICU, you start to see their faces metaphorically in some of the people you're caring for.
I think if they can be called a silver lining, I think one of the few silver linings in this pandemic is that for me and hopefully, and I really hope for a lot of people, that we realize how important it is to reach out to the people we love. And I think that's the one, like I said, beautiful part of this is that it's going to make people feel connected. And that's what I hope for. And it's one that I think we should never forget. And I hope more than anything that it changes things, whether it be for healthcare or for racial equality or for better access to health, to primary care providers, or just, I hope it makes the world better because of how much we suffered.
On this issue of healthcare workers like yourself being celebrated as heroes, you said many times in your piece that you don't feel like a hero. And you also said, don't mistake my career choice for me wanting to be a martyr. I have a future, you wrote, that I want to live out. I want to grow to be an old man, basically.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. You know, we should want to grow old. We should want to live full, long lives, and hopefully ones that are full of opportunity and happiness. And I've seen so many people have said, oh, like, A, you're a nurse, you should be used to death, or B, like, you should be accustomed to putting your life on the line. And I'm like, that's not healthcare, you know? And I can only say I speak for myself, but ultimately I hope other healthcare workers agree with this, in that I signed up to do good work and to come to work and to help people. And I want to go home. I want to go home. I want to see a future ahead of myself, and I want to go back to work the next day, motivated to do good work.
As I'm sure you're aware, there's this ongoing debate in the country about, are the stay-at-home restrictions too much? Should we start to loosen them up? Should we get the economy going again? You have a perspective on this pandemic that's unique to almost anyone else in the country. From your perspective, what do you think of that debate?
I think the main thing that bothers me is I'm scared for the people who are going to die who didn't have to die. And I speak on this because as a nurse, I'm very lucky to have a job. Like, I don't want people to think that I'm not aware of this. I'm very fortunate because I get to have a job, and I will never say I understand, because I don't. I don't understand what it's like for struggling families who are living paycheck to paycheck, whose stimulus checks are barely enough to cover 3-4 days worth of food and other things that they might need to provide for. But I'm for us opening the economy in a way that's safe. If we could bring cameras in and we could show people what's happening, I don't think people would be as, you know, they wouldn't diminish it as a hoax. They wouldn't be so blatantly sweeping it over as nothing more than a flu. And I just wish that I had an answer. But all I can say is that from my perspective as a nurse, I just don't want to see any more people die.
All right, KP Mendoza, ICU nurse working in New York City. Thank you very, very much for your time, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And you can read an open letter KP Mendoza wrote about his experience and what he hopes we keep in mind when this is all over on our website, pbs.org/newshour. Republicans and Democrats in Congress continue to debate whether or not the federal government should financially help struggling state and local governments who've seen their budgets balloon during this pandemic. Earlier today, I spoke with Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, whose husband has recovered from COVID-19, about Congress's role in all of this and more. Senator Amy Klobuchar, thank you so much for joining us. Your home state of Minnesota, I took a look at it. Compared to neighboring Wisconsin, you've got about the same population, but Minnesota has only about half the number of COVID-19 cases. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Our governor and our elected officials have tried as much to speak as one voice, and we've been very clear about the governor has about people staying at home. We've also looked at things like hunting and fishing and keeping that open, as well as some of our home repairs, things like that. I think that has helped in trying to figure out, and no one is going to figure out the right formula. No one's seen anything like this before, but we're trying to do our best. The other thing we've done recently is I've worked hard to get Mayo's serum test approved in Washington, and now we've reached an agreement, the governor has, with Mayo and University of Minnesota. So the plan is to be testing up to 20,000 a day, which for a state of our size is pretty significant. And the one thing I'd add, though, Judy, is what we've seen in our state, like you've seen all over the country in Georgia and other places, the highest per capita is sometimes rural areas, not the highest gross number of cases, but the highest per capita. And I am really concerned that we're not prepared for rural America. Of course, we have more seniors. We have less of hospitals and ventilators and the like. And so we really have to start focusing on that.
That's a story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. Senator Klobuchar, now that we've Congress has moved on, it's passed the fourth package of aid for small businesses, for people who are out of work. There are questions being raised about money that went to people, to organizations, businesses that it shouldn't have. How do you know that in the next go-around that's not going to happen again?
Well, I think a lot of this is going to be enforcement and oversight. And I actually just brought a bunch of senators together on a letter about unjust enrichment to figure out exactly what's happening here, because there's no doubt when this kind of money's going out, you've got to have heavy-duty oversight and enforcement. And I'm concerned that this administration, I mean, sign one was when the president fired the inspector general, who had vast experience at both the Department of Defense and the Justice Department for the major oversight of the money going out. That has to be watched.
With the debate beginning now for this next round, we know Democrats are pushing for billions for state and local governments. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is saying he wants to put the brakes on that. A report today from the Congressional Budget Office, the deficit this year, $3.7 trillion. How do you make the case, Senator McConnell talking about having states declare bankruptcy, how do you make the case that money should go to state and local governments?
Well, let's start back. The first thing I would have done before we had this pandemic was not pass that Republican tax bill. And I know that seems like old news, but that was $1 trillion, and Democrats voted uniformly against that bill. So there are some inequities right now in our system that after this pandemic we must repair that would help us greatly with this deficit. The second thing. Right now, we are in a national emergency, and the state and local governments need help. A lot of them have limited budgets. They're not able to basically put more money out like the federal government. And that's why we're focused on this. The third thing is, just now, we were the ones that had to push for the testing money, $25 billion. And if the president had prepared for this earlier and gotten the testing out, we would have been in better shape with our economy.
One other thing, two other things I want to ask you about very quickly, Senator. One is the push by you and other Democrats for money for the states for mail-in voting and for early voting. Again, Senator McConnell, the majority leader, is saying this is not going to happen. You can't do it. He's got the control in the Senate with the majority.
Well, I'm sure that is a negotiating tactic, but maybe he should talk to some of the people in Wisconsin who stood in line in garbage bags and homemade masks while the president of the United States was able to vote from the comfort of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue by sending in for a mail-in ballot from Palm Beach, Florida. People across the country, Democrats and Republicans, want to see more mail-in ballots. Governors, Republican governors in New Hampshire, Maryland, Ohio, have called for going to all mail-in ballots. We also have to have the polls open earlier for 20 days. So he has said this before, Senator McConnell, but we were able to get over $400 million in the first bill, and now we need to do more. And that's why Senator Wyden and I are leading the effort for the bill to make sure we've got reforms in place as well as more funding. This is not a Democratic issue. It is a United States of America issue.
Speaking of the election, Vice President Biden has said he will choose a woman as his running mate. when both Senator Elizabeth Warren and the former Georgia Lieutenant Governor Stacey Abrams were asked about this. They said they were definitely interested. You've said it's a hypothetical, but it is a decision he's going to be making. Why not just come out and say one way or another whether you're interested?
Because I am focused right now on the people of this country and the people of my state in this pandemic. And I do believe it's a hypothetical because he's going to be making his own decision about who to ask. And no one knows better than Joe Biden. He was a great vice president with President Obama. He was a great vice president when it came to some of the
issues. But it's clear that you're on the short list.
Accountability. Well, we take each step at a time. And right now, I'm doing my job. And I'm helping Joe Biden across the country. I think that's very important. And I'm glad he's been getting out there and people are seeing him on TV and the like, because people have to understand that there is an alternative to a president of the United States that just yesterday gets on TV to the nation and makes a joke, now we find out it is, about that you can drink disinfectant or bleach and that that's how going to help you. So I just think we need a leader, and that is what I'm focused on, helping Joe Biden, that's going to be able to bring competence and empathy to the White House. And we don't have that right now.
Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Judy.
Coronavirus infections and deaths are ripping through the Navajo Nation, located in three different states. With an already vulnerable population, coordinating care and information is not easy. As the NewsHour's Stephanie Tsai reports, the community has taken on the challenge of caring for their own people.
In Navajo country, COVID-19 found its grip at a religious revival event in early March in the upper western reaches of the reservation.
We have clan families that come all over the Navajo Nation to participate in these events. And boy, it just took off like wildfire after that.
After the so-called super spreader event in Chichen Bito, President Jonathan Nez put increasingly strict orders for social distancing in place, including weekend curfews.
I haven't even personally myself been able to hug my grandma, stand at the door, drop off all the stuff on the porch, and I just wave at her. That's it.
At least 52 people who live on Navajo Nation have died from COVID-19, including one of 18-year-old welder Trevor Tachitny's relatives.
One person on the other side of my family has got it and has passed. I'm very concerned about it because I have family members that are young and are susceptible to it, and it's scaring my mother and my father. Every time we go out.
Getting the message out about social distancing on the reservation was initially difficult. Nez broadcast daily updates on Facebook, but many households lack quality internet access. It's also not practical for many on the reservation to follow stay-at-home orders. Sprawling across three states with a population of more than 173,000, wide swaths of the Navajo Nation are energy, food, and healthcare deserts. And actual desert with limited water.
We tell people to wash their hands, but a study showed 30% of the homes on Navajo Nation don't have running water.
You know, we're a vulnerable population.
One in five Native Americans has diabetes, and there's a high prevalence of obesity, both underlying conditions that can make COVID-19 particularly dangerous. Even the younger people on Navajo Nation have worse health outcomes.
We are seeing some patients that are not over 60 that are coming in with severe COVID illness because, and they almost all have comorbid conditions.
Dr. Diana Hu has been working at the Tuba City Regional Healthcare Center for more than 30 years. The pediatric ward where she normally works has been turned into a respiratory clinic, as has much of the hospital since COVID-19 struck.
It was actually almost more like a tsunami when this first started in the middle of March, where we had, you know, 9 or 10 people getting sick in a day that had to be flown out for tertiary care. We get maybe 1 or 2 a day, and it's real obvious when they're sick, unfortunately.
Many Native American hospitals are not equipped for multiple severe ventilator cases. For now, patients are airlifted to facilities in Phoenix and Flagstaff. But Dr. Hu and her colleagues are bracing for an overwhelming surge.
If you know any nurses that want to come work up here, we'd love to have them.
This week, the University of California, San Francisco sent 14 nurses and 7 physicians to Navajo Nation to help. The most pressing shortage has been personnel.
And this thing has not peaked on the Navajo Nation.
We're not sure. If you look at our statistics, which are per capita, it's outrageous. The biggest issue I think that we have with the federal government structure, the coordination is pitting tiny places like us against states, against other hospitals, and the coordination is being left up to the states, which is very difficult when you have something like the Navajo Nation.
Navajo Nation has one of the highest rates in the country of COVID-19 on a per capita basis, behind only New York and New Jersey. In Arizona, about 20% of deaths from COVID-19 have been Native Americans, when they make up only 5% of the state's population. The CARES Act granted $8 billion to stabilize tribal communities, but the more than 500 sovereign tribes had collectively asked for closer to $20 billion. The Navajo have been the worst affected, but other tribes are facing the same threat. In New Mexico, multiple Native Pueblo communities are seeing infection rates of coronavirus higher than big cities. And the Red Lake community in Minnesota declared medical martial law several weeks ago, containing their spread to one person. Back on Navajo lands, President Nez described the frustrating process of accessing federal funds.
It's taken too long. Here in Indian country, we're always, it seems to me, we're always at the bottom of the list when it comes to federal resources.
The health disparities laid bare by COVID-19 have reverberated across the Navajo Nation since the time of European colonization. In 2009, the H1N1 flu was 4 times as deadly in Native peoples as it was in the general population. During the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, a similar story.
We can't change history. We should just hopefully learn from it.
In recent days, vital resources have been delivered. Rapid test kits that President Nez says can give results in less than an hour. The National Guard has brought in supplies, initially from its own stockpile of masks and other protective gear. And people are stepping up to fill the needs of their neighbors. Navajo sewing masks for frontline workers.
I delivered some to Kayenta Health Center, and they've been wanting more masks.
Navajo delivering supplies to the most isolated residents.
We definitely see the need to make food and supplies like toilet paper and soap available during this time.
We came across an elder who lives alone and he has no food. So we packed extra so that we're able to give in case we run into this type of situation.
And Navajo coming together in shared struggle.
We're encouraging our elders to share their stories, the stories of our culture, our tradition, and our language, so that our young people don't remember this time as a scary moment. This is, in a way, what we've been praying for, to reunite families, to reunite couples, to hand down our language, our culture, tradition to the next generation.
It may be an optimistic way of looking at a pandemic, but it's the stories the Navajo tell that have helped them endure. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix.
And now we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks, that is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. So all three of us are at our homes. It's great to see both you, Mark, and you, David, staying safe. Let's start with President Trump's decision to turn over to the governors, the decision about whether and when to open up. Mark, we've seen the state of Georgia, other states moving quickly to reverse the stay-at-home orders. There are questions being raised about whether it's too early. The president himself at point backing down on his support for this. How do you read all this?
You have to watch it closely, Judy. I mean, last weekend, the president was in bold type, tweeting out to liberate Minnesota, liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia. to put pressure on Democratic governors there to lift the bans and lift the quarantine. So Doug Kemp, the governor of Georgia, who was the last in the country to impose stay-at-home rules, wants to be the first to lift them, and thought he had a green light from the president, I guess. But the president doesn't forget the fact that while he is a loyal supporter of Mr. Kemp's, it's an off and on thing, because Kemp, if you'll recall, just at a petty political point, instead of appointing to Johnny Isaacson's vacancy in the United States Senate, Doug Collins, the congressman from Georgia who had been so close to the president, he appointed instead Kelly Loeffler. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump, the president, was told, according to reports from CNN, by Anthony Fauci, Dr. Anthony Fauci, that he could not support and would not defend the lifting of the quarantine in Georgia. So he backed off. And it appears to be a cynical political ploy with the following formula. For anything that improves the economy, the president gets credit. For any increase in the pandemic and incidence of disease and death, then it's been the decision of the governor.
And so, David, I mean, the president, by doing this, is passing on responsibility to the governors, for better or worse.
Yeah, and I'm happy about it. I don't want life or death decisions made by a guy who thinks this can be solved by drinking disinfectant. So if you can get it out of the White House, we're getting into safer and better hands. There's like a division of powers here. The federal government is there to dole out money and to organize some of the testing and things like that. And so far, it's doing a reasonably good job of doling out a lot of money. But the states are there to make the decisions about their own states. If you had people in Wyoming thinking that Washington was going to determine their life or death, they would rebel against Washington. If you had a lot of progressive areas thinking that Donald Trump was going to determine life or death decisions, they would rebel against Donald Trump. So I think it's just much better to be doing this on the local level. The one final thing I'll say, we tend to jam up conflict, but in this, I think we're overstating how much conflict there is in America. Americans, considering how polarized, we're amazingly united right now. 98% of Democrats and 82% of Republicans support the social distancing. 90% of Americans, complete bipartisan consensus, believe that if we loosen too much, there'd be a second wave. 76% of Americans say even if their governor did loosen, they wouldn't go out. And so to me, the big story here is we're sort of hanging together through this.
Evidently so, if you believe those polls. But Mark, going back to what David mentioned a moment ago, and that is the president's statement yesterday about injecting ultraviolet light or disinfectant into ourselves. I mean, today the White House is saying that was just a joke. They didn't mean it. But there have been other statements that he's made about endorsing this anti-malaria drug that the experts are saying cannot be relied on. What are the American people to make of all this?
Well, Judy, I think maybe the most unreported story of the week was Piers Morgan, the British television journalist, who's a friend of the president, one of the 47 people on Twitter the president has access to. He's given three interviews to British television, all his presidency, all three to Piers Morgan. And Piers Morgan went public and said what an awful lot of Trump supporters and Trump critics have been saying, and that is, Mr. President, you're really hurting yourself in these television daily conferences, that you're coming across as self-aggrandizing, as self-interested, as really not a leader, concerned more basically about your own re-election than you are about the health and well-being of the people who elected you. And I really think that that crystallized criticism. A number of Republicans have followed, and I think you'll see the president backing off. Yesterday's performance was the worst. I mean, to say Lysol is a possibility for inhalation, sarcastically, he's not Will Rogers. He's not Jerry Seinfeld. He's not a man known for a sense of humor. It wasn't sarcasm. It was just Donald Trump being absolutely reckless and irresponsible. And I think the quicker they've seen his numbers drop. And I think that the daily press conference has been the principal contributing factor to it.
And David, just in the last hour, the White House has let it be known that they are now going to be cutting short these daily briefings, some of which have gone on for 2 hours and longer. So, I mean, how much in the end does it matter what the president is saying at a time like this? Are the American people, how much do they need to hear from their political leader, and how much do they need to hear from medical experts?
They need medical experts. It's a morale destroyer. It's tough on morale. It's a drain on all of us. And even the Trump supporters feel drained by his foolery. But I don't think it's really damaged the way people act. A funny thing has happened. I noticed in my local grocery store, like a month ago, maybe 5% of the people were wearing masks. Then it was 30%. And then it suddenly flipped and was 70%. And starting 2 weeks ago, if you weren't wearing a mask, even before the law came down, people spoke to you and said, you need to go get a mask. And so what that shows to me is a community setting new norms, setting new moral standards, having new expectations of how we should protect one another. And when I see a community acting as one, like in the grocery store, and we all see it, then you see a community that's basically healthy, that where people are understand the obligations they have to each other. And that was not automatic going into this. Most plagues, that's not how people behave. So I think it hurts our morale, what Trump does, but I wouldn't say it's destroyed it.
Interesting what you say about, you see people at the grocery store, we're seeing much this the same thing. David, I mean, Mark, I want to quickly come to what Congress was able to do this week, and that is in passing legislation to provide more support for small businesses, some of it for hospitals and others. How much difference is this aid going to make? How much more is going to be needed? We're already seeing worry about the size of the deficit, of the debt the country is going to owe when all this is over. Where does the argument land there?
I don't know how much difference it's going to make. I say this, Judy, the immortal Dante, as FDR referred to him, weighs the sins of the cold-hearted and the sins of the warm-hearted on a different scale. In other words, this is reaching out to people who had been left out of the first aid, to minorities, to women, to small, really small businesses, not publicly traded companies, which hundreds of millions of dollars of small business aid went to hospitals, the people who are on the front line and dealing with this terrible tragedy every day. To me, it showed an awareness and an understanding. I don't think anybody understands the gravity economically. It is enormous. It will be enormous. Right now, what we've seen is sort of a bait and switch on the part of Republicans. They said, oh, you could do the aid to local cities and states. And the next one, I said, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House leader, and now Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, says there will be no next one.
So, David, just in a few words, how much is the worry about the debt, the deficit, going to be part of this going forward as people are hurting?
Yeah, I don't think it should be. In wartime, even fiscal conservatives believe in spending. They've done a good thing. This Paycheck Protection Act for small businesses, it's impressive how much money they've gotten out the door. There's somebody in the Small Business Administration who's probably working 18-hour days. A lot of people are probably working days to get that much money. I've sort of been impressed by how much they've got out the door, the money for testing. They're bickering, but they did something good this week. They spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and they passed a very complicated piece of legislation on a bipartisan basis. It's funny to me that the members of Congress, even when they do something good, they can't take a victory lap. They're so used to just bickering and bickering and bickering.
In just about 45 seconds we have left, I want to ask each of you how you're doing, staying at home all the time, or almost all the time. Mark, how is it going?
Well, Judy, I'm rereading Tolstoy for the third time, and no, I'm not. I've rearranged my sock drawer, and I'm doing fine. I've got a wonderful roommate, and I've had the same one for half a century, and I'm just finding new and wonderful things about her every day.
Pretty great roommate. We know Ann Shields. David, what about you? How are you holding up? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm blessed. I've got a good five group of people here in my little Forge family, and I'm playing my son in ping pong ferociously. I'm hoping to develop a backhand by the end of this. So there are little blessings amid the great worry that we're all going through, but there are little blessings, even in these days with family.
I feel the same way, so much more to be grateful for than the other way around. Well, we are grateful to the two of you, David Brooks, Mark Shields. Thank you, and please stay safe.
Thank you, Judy.
Again, on this Friday night, we remember a few of the tens of thousands of Americans who have passed away from this virus. It's part of our continuing effort to honor the public servants and community leaders we've lost. Robin Hardy became a pastor when she was 25 years old and served as vice president of her church in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Her children remember a unifier, both in church and as the founder of a mentorship program for girls, where they say she reached more than 1,000 women and did so in style. Hardy was 56 years old. Pediatric neurosurgeon Dr. James Goodrich of New York's Montefiore Medical Center garnered international acclaim for successfully separating 10 twins conjoined at the head and advising dozens of other such surgeries. Outside the operating room, the 73-year-old was a bonsai tree enthusiast. He had a library of rare antique medical books and was an avid player of the Australian Aboriginal instrument, the didgeridoo. His friends dubbed him the most interesting man in the world. Vitalina Williams loved gardening and cooking with her husband in Salem, Massachusetts, when she wasn't working her two jobs at the local grocery store and Walmart. Bold and principled, Williams was known as the CEO and CFO of her family. She came to the United States from Guatemala in the 1990s and spoke to her family there on the phone every day. She was 56 years old. 61-year-old Quincy Simpson, a correctional officer at New York's Rikers Island, was known for his calm demeanor, great sense of humor, and hard work ethic. When he contracted COVID-19, Quincy called in sick for only the second time in his 18 years on the job. He was a mentor to the basketball players he coached, neighborhood school kids, and his 6-year-old son, Aiden. Karen Ketcher dedicated her career to serving Native American tribes in her home state of Oklahoma and across the country. Karen loved to sew, including memorable prom and wedding dresses, and spent all of her free time with her family, her grandkids, and great-grandkids. In Tahlequah's Cherokee Nation, she was known as everyone's Granny Karen for loving everyone in the community like they were her own. She was 70 years old. And we honor each one of them. They are a loss to their loved ones, and our condolences to everyone. And on the NewsHour online right now, messages of hope and appreciation are appearing on sidewalks around the country. We talk to artists, both amateur and professional, about how they're connecting with others through chalk art. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for this Friday night. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe, as always, and good night.